When I was doing youth ministry, and I have done it here, I used to talk about the tongue. And the way I did it is I'd set up the youth group in the house that we were meeting at, and I had this big plastic bag, and it was pretty heavy, and I would ask them, I need a volunteer, preferably a girl, to come up and take out of the bag what was in it and show it to the rest of the group. Of course, when you're putting your hand in a bag that I wouldn't let them look into, that's always a bit nerve-wracking because they don't know what they're reaching in for. So as we would, I got one gal up there one time and she went to reach into it. And literally her hand was shaking so bad because she was afraid what she was going to touch that she at some point just sat down and said, I can't do it. And I went through two or three gals that would just get up there, they get their hand halfway in and then they'd start shaking, they get out and they go, I can't do it. Well, I finally got one brave gal that came up there and went, enough of this. She reached in there, pulled out the cow tongue that I had sitting in there that was probably this long, absolutely panicked and threw it into the crowd of kids. And as I was preparing for this mini-series that we're doing, I was thinking, well, that's kind of what we're doing today in this four-week series on God and homosexuality. We're going to reach into the depth of the scriptures and pull out truth that we might be more terrified of than anything else that's in the scriptures, because we know it's one of the hottest, most sensitive issues and topics that we deal with in our culture. And yet we have to come to the scriptures and say that if we believe this is God's revelation for us, we have to, however we feel, need to figure out what God's authority is in terms of how we view this. So let me try to help you think about this morning, in that we're going to do a four-week series. This week I'm going to introduce to you the subject, as it were, and I'm going to spend, actually I got a lot of PowerPoints, but I'm going to work through a different position than what maybe most of you hold, but not necessarily, and that is there's a revisionist perspective of many people who are Christians who say that gay and lesbian lifestyle is fine, and they will say that they believe that the scriptures support that idea. And I want you to help understand that a little bit, because some of us would look at it and go, that seems impossible. When I just read the scriptures that talk about this, if you have done that, you kind of go, I have no idea how they get to that conclusion, because for some of us it looks like an open and shut case. So then after I do that, I'm going to walk through a little bit of my questions and, let's say, confusion when I hear some of those things, and at least raise them for you in terms of how do we critically think through this from a scriptural perspective. But let me say in advance that the next 4 weeks kind of link together. It's one of those few times that it's a subject that's impossible to deal with everything exhaustively. It's even tougher to deal with it in four-week segments. So it's helpful, even if you can't be here every week, to listen to the whole package, because if you don't, you're going to have gaps in the way that you think about this. Why is it important? Well, I think Christ came and died for everyone. And so as we begin to think about the implications of that, whether a person's different than us in terms of our own social economic status or sexual attractions and those kind of things, I believe Christ came and died for everyone. And so the idea here is, how do we think through this? So as we begin to think, I want to walk you through Romans 1, 26 and through 27. Today it's a little bit of a springboard to understand some of the basic ways that people think about this before they come to the scriptures and as they interpret the scriptures. And if you don't understand that, then it's hard to know how to interact with that in a reasonable sense. But simply put, as we begin to look at it, for this reason God gave them over to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged the natural sexual relations for unnatural ones, and likewise the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed in their passions for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and received in themselves the due penalty of their error. So before we jump wholeheartedly in the text, which we will be there this morning at some point, let me walk you through some of the basic positions that end up swimming around, at least in Christian circles. So there's two basic positions, even though it may seem oversimplistic. And then there's four ways to sort of look at how we interpret the scriptures. So let me walk you through that a little bit, just in terms of understanding the basic framework. The basic position starts with a restrictive perspective, which simply says certain restrictions are placed on participating of sexual active gays in the church. So there's some churches who will have restrictions. Some of them will simply say total rejection. If you're going to practice gay and homosexual life, then you're not welcome here, because the idea is that contradicts our understanding of the scriptures and it's not going to fit. There's other churches that will accept them as participating members, but will restrict people from having certain leadership positions because that's sort of off limits. That's where the line is drawn in terms of certain restrictions. They want them to be part of the family, part of the community, try to learn to grow in God's righteousness. But the trouble is that if there's a conviction that that's not proper, we can't have leaders operating knowingly in a way that's not proper. So that becomes part of the debate in terms of how we understand it. So that's the restrictive perspective. The other one is what is called, is an inclusive perspective. There we go, thank you. And that is, and I'm quoting this from Ted Grimsrud, who is a pastor in Portland, Oregon, who I've interacted with him, and Matthew Vines is sort of the college student now who took a couple years off and wrote a whole dissertation type thing on this because he grew up in a Christian family. In his mind, discovered that he was gay and is trying to harmonize, wanting to live for God, but struggling to understand how the scriptures are. And so the inclusive perspective comes from Ted, and this is his words, that the quote-unquote gayness of a church person, including being in a committed same-sex relationship, should have no bearing on church participation. And this is based on the moral values that would apply to heterosexual marriage or individuals in terms of that morality, should also apply to gay couples and lesbian couples outside of how they would define that partnership. So they wouldn't think that immorality outside of that relationship would be acceptable either. And this covenant partnership is one that they would acknowledge. So those are the two basic positions. There's a restrictive one where there's certain limitations on how churches respond to practicing gays and homosexuals. And then there's this inclusive position, and that influences how people interpret the Bible. So let me walk you through some of these approaches. The first one is a restrictive with a more conservative biblical hermeneutic. When I mean hermeneutic, that's a fancy word to say of how I interpret the Bible. And so the focus is on direct references, and some of you might be familiar with this or grew up with it. The Bible opposes homosexuality, and we should too. And so that's why it's called restrictive, and it's a conservative hermeneutic, or the way that they interpret the Bible, because from reading it, even the verses we read, they go, I don't understand what the discussion is. And as we walk through this over the next 4 weeks, I'm hoping, at least even this morning, to give you, here's the way that this is thought about by others. The next position is what is called a restrictive with a less conservative biblical hermeneutic. And the focus here is on natural law. In other words, the Bible is not necessarily the central authority. Doesn't mean it's eliminated, but it's not the central authority on how this is determined. It's just based on the idea that this isn't natural. This isn't what seems to be normal. And as Ted indicates, typically a Roman Catholic position would rest here, even though there's going to be variations all across the board depending on how a church leadership identifies that process. So those are the restrictive ones, and then there is an inclusive. This thing shrunk on me, so I can't actually tell if I'm on the right slide with this one. The inclusive one with a more conservative hermeneutic, and this is the one that Ted picks on, and this was helpful for you to understand. The Bible does not oppose homosexuality, since it supports the inclusion of vulnerable people, and so should we. So what you will discover as you walk through this is for those who are inclusionist, they're going to look at biblical themes that they say would take precedent over specific texts or things that are said. And I'll walk through that a little bit this morning as we begin to think through that process. So that is the inclusive one with a less conservative hermeneutic. And you need to know, as Ted Grimsrud wrote this, and I'm working a lot from his framework just to limit the discussion a little bit here. He grew up in a Christian home. He's obviously a pastor, but he became very disenfranchised with Christians who seemed to be very hostile, critical, and judgmental of gays and lesbians. He grew up in an environment where people seemed to be very legalistic. There's no issue about this, and whatever other language went with it, it really bothered him immensely that people would be this harsh who are supposed to be loving and like Christ-like. He didn't see that part of it in them. He's also a pacifist. And so on top of this idea that he sort of pushed back on how he saw Christians acting, he was a pacifist just in the general sense of life. And so this is why he approaches the scripture from this particular vantage point or this particular perspective. So that's the, thank you. So that's the framework that he comes from in terms of what's going on. And then there's a fourth one, which is inclusiveness with a less conservative biblical hermeneutic, and that's basically on libertarian texts, that the basically statements that you see that might suggest anti-gay or lesbian practices are inapplicable because they just ignore it. They don't. The Bible might be a guidebook, but it doesn't have final authority, and this is where our culture's going, and so they just accept it. And you'll find churches that will do this just because they think Jesus loved everybody, and so we should just love people and not worry about those things. Christopher Ewan, as I've gone, Grant and I are headed to Moody, Chicago for the Moody Pastors Conference next week. Christopher Ewan is a professor there. He came out of the gay lifestyle, and he advocates this sense of how do we think about this. He had a helpful thought in terms of just this basic way that people interpret things. Traditionally, we have a sense that the scripture is the final authority. Then there's this sense of reason and science, and then our experience terms it. His evaluation of those who revise the scriptures to help support this idea that gay and homosexuality is not an issue from the scriptures, he believes comes from the idea that they're working from experience and what people are feeling, then goes to reason and science, and then finally to the scriptures. I don't know if it's that harsh or not, but that's just so that you understand the mindset of people coming from different fears of thought and theology, that if you don't have some sense of this, this can get confusing. Not that we're going to make it comfortable or simple, but it's helpful to understand those elements. Grimsrud will also say that he does not believe that the authority of the scriptures is the issue. It's how you interpret the particular text. So they would still support that the scriptures are the authoritative. His position, as I said, is the third one that I mentioned to you. But he has this sense of being inclusive, and so we want to sort of pursue that to see how people are welcome, how that works in churches. So here's the terms that I think would be helpful for you to sort of get in your head if you want to understand the revisionist position where Christians are saying that gay lifestyle is okay. The one word is inclusiveness, and I've already worked through that. But the two other terms that we're going to talk about this morning is the one of hospitality. It's basically a biblical theme that they feel trumps almost everything in terms of how you look at the scriptures and how you deal with these particular texts. The other one is what they call the theology of welcome. And they believe that Jesus modeled this theology of welcome where he welcomed those, especially in the first century, where the religious system tended to reject them and ostracize them. Jesus was very much out to welcome those people to himself. And so we'll talk about that in detail in terms of text, but he's saying, listen, if we're going to have to choose between religious establishment and the model of Jesus, we're going to follow Jesus. Okay, sounds pretty spiritual, doesn't it? And I don't want you to be dismissive. I want you to hear the strengths of their argument as well as talk a little bit about the struggles that I would have or the weaknesses that we might see in it as well. Because there are some things that I think are important to listen to. So these are the terms that we want to talk about, and I want to try to walk it through with you. And just because if it feels like I'm hurrying, I've got like 60 slides that I want to try to get through. So if you got a flash camera that goes at like 100 speed, that's the best way to keep up. Anyway, the first one here is a theology of hospitality. And that basically is the idea of showing kindness and welcoming guests, strangers, and others in need. It's a very simple one, but for instance, as you talk about it, one of the texts that you go back and deal with in the Old Testament are two. One is Leviticus 18 through 20, which is the holiness code. The other one is in Genesis 18 through 20, which is basically the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. How God, two angels come to Abram, and they're passing on, heading towards Sodom. And Abraham shows this tremendous hospitality. And we know from Middle Eastern practices that hospitality is a huge issue. And if you understand it, it's way different than the way we think about it. And part of their argument is we really just don't understand how strong and how powerful this sense of hospitality is. Abraham demonstrates hospitality to it. He feeds them, he cares for them, and even resists when they want to leave to make sure that they are fully supplied in terms of their own needs. But God finally reveals to Abraham what's going to happen, and goes through that whole dialogue with God. Well, wait a minute, wonder if there's 50 righteous people in Sodom? Because God's message is this city is so wicked, I have to destroy it. It's just absolutely up to their gills, saturated with evil and wickedness and sin and idolatry and iniquity. And so they go through this discussion. I wonder if there's 40 righteous people. God says, yeah, I'll do it, but I can tell you right now, there isn't 40 righteous people in this town. How about 30? How about 20? How about 10? And nothing's working in this discussion. And so we know the story. The angels go down and they want to stay in the town square. And Lot lives down there with his family, and he greets them and encourages them to come into his home as being hospitable. And they say, no, we'll just stay here. And he goes, that's not an option. You need to come into my house. And so he, in a sense, almost forces them to. And then we're told that the whole city, all the men mostly, come out, and they want to get these strangers. And it says, we want to get to know them. And which is generally translated as the idea of we want to have sexual relationships with them. And of course, men with men and all those kind of things, they probably don't know that they were angels, but the idea is, Lot goes, look, I got daughters, do something to them, but that shows you how strong the hospitality is, but don't touch these guests that are in my home. Even as it were, it seems like he's willing to sacrifice his daughters at the expense of protecting these guests who are in his home. So we see the power of this sense of hospitality. And so as it goes through there, one of the things that will be said as you look at this argument is that the issue here isn't really homosexuality and covenant-loving relationships. The problem here is about gang rape. It's about people who are going to exploit others in a very vicious and humiliating way. It's not about loving, caring homosexual relationships. And so they discard this passage, as it were, because it's not speaking to it. And Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 49 is the verse that's often used to support the fact that hospitality is the issue here, not homosexuality. Ezekiel 16, 49 says, behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease, but she did not help the poor and the needy. And so when you go to Ezekiel, it specifically states, here's what their sin was. And so it was a violation of being hospitable and caring for people. The same thing in Matthew chapter 10. When Jesus sends out the 12, they are going into the villages, not of the Gentiles, but of Israel. And they are going out there, and there's several verses that talk about, listen, if you are welcomed by them and they welcome you into your home, then fine. If they reject you and won't be hospitable to you, then the verse basically says, and whoever does not receive you, nor heed your words, as you go out of that house or city, shake off the dust of your feet. Truly I say to you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. And so the argument is, because they were inhospitable to you, their judgment is going to be worse than Sodom and Gomorrah. So the idea is, it wasn't homosexuality, it was being inhospitable to these strangers who came into your city or town, and that's the demonstration of their judgment. So the question is, how do you start thinking through that? That begins to build what they would say is their case or their argument as for this idea that the issue here is being inhospitable. Now, Leviticus does the same thing. Leviticus 18, there are some statements here that Ted addresses in his article, as well as others. And these seem pretty explicit to us. You shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination. If there is a man who lies with a male as those who lie with a woman, both of them have committed a detestable act. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. Now here's, if I want to do a direct quote from Ted, this is the statement that he makes, which I find quite interesting. Certainly Leviticus 18 and 22 and 20:13 clearly condemn some sort of male sex. However, in the absence of clear, universalizable basis for such a condemnation, we do not have enough evidence to generalize from these two rather cryptic references. Cryptic meaning there's kind of hidden, or it's subtle, or it's not really overt. I'm not sure why he puts that in there. It seems pretty overt to me, but in any event, these two verses are not sufficient in themselves to conclude that the Bible condemns homosexuality as a broad category, including both men and women. So that's the way that we're looking at the scriptures. That's what becomes something we can't ignore, is that what it's really dealing with? Now, I know it's a lot, and we can't deal with everything, but as you begin to think through this, here's the argument that they would say is problematic for Christians. The holiness code is primarily concerned for all members of the community. That's the hospitality part, is what they look at the holiness code. They say this does mostly about how people treat one another when you look at it. There's all kinds of things about how not to dress and how not to treat one another and these kinds of practices that were very typical through there. It's, you know, you don't boil a goat's in its mother's milk and all that kind of stuff. But it also deals with these kinds of issues related to sexual relationships, and there's whole sections to it. So the holiness code is about, as he's talking about it, about concern for members of community. Holiness is to imitate God, love your neighbor, and care for the vulnerable, which is a statement that certainly in part, maybe not as the final purpose, but certainly in part true about what the holiness code was supposed to be. But then they'll say, Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament law, and therefore the law is not applicable. I mean, we talk about that all the time. Jesus fulfilled all the elements of the Old Testament covenant. If you look at Colossians, it'll talk about these things, that he is the substance of everything that the Old Testament foreshadowed. And so therefore, it's not relevant. And then they would say that Christians tend to pick and choose what's relevant there anyway. There are certain practices that we seem to hang on to, like moral codes, and there's other things that we just seem to ignore. And so they said it's not very consistent, so why are we making an issue about this? So as you begin to walk through it, I hope you're understanding a little bit as this is the way people are thinking about how this works. Having said that, let me deal with the theology of welcome, because that helps bring Jesus into the discussion. And it says simply that almost everyone affirms that Jesus taught and practiced love. Certainly, Jesus' portrayal of love stands at the center of his message. Anybody disagree with that? Good. Because I think he did show love, but I'm not sure it's saying enough in terms of what was going on. And so as you begin to look at it, it's like, well, what did Jesus model? Here is one text that he uses, and I will come back to this after I've sort of presented the case for this, is that it says, Jesus was going about all the cities and the villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. So Ted's statement is this. This section of Matthew shows that the good news of the kingdom includes both Jesus' teaching and healing ministries, and the church should be about the same thing. It should be about welcoming others who are different than they. It ought to be teaching about what he wants, and it ought to be about healing people. And so as he talks about this, he basically describes the idea of the church as this. Throughout the Bible, Bible's call for God's people to form communities of healing finds expression in the highest priority, the high priority placed on the virtue of hospitality. This is the first theme that points toward the benefit of the doubt for an inclusiveness with others. A community's hospitality expresses his faithfulness, their faithfulness to God. Now, there's some good points in there. The idea of hospitality and welcoming and this sense of God's grace and this sense of welcoming people, that's what God has us for. We're a community that are to be a kingdom of priests that are mediate the gospel of Jesus Christ to a lost world. It's broken. We know it's broken. Does that not make sense to us? And so part of the argument is Jesus never explicitly condemned homosexuality. He talked about divorce. Talked about marriage, never actually comes out and explicitly condemns homosexuality. So if Jesus didn't do it, then why are we doing it? And so that becomes a question that we have to sort of think through and grapple with is, okay, well, what did Jesus do? And so as we get down to actually the text that we're talking about, what they will do when they approach Romans 1 is that they'll say, look, there's a real larger context here. From 1:18 to chapter 3, verse 20, the issue here is not just about, is primarily about injustices. I mean, that's what Romans 1:18 says. For the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness, and most of your Bibles will say unrighteousness, which is an appropriate term to use. They will say that's a mistranslation and say it should be injustices. And so if you look at what's happening there, and if you don't come back next week, you won't understand this fully because I'm going to deal more with the nuances of verse 26 and 27 next week. But they'll say, well, if you go to chapter 2, verse 1, he says, what about you guys that are standing over here that are condemning the people in chapter 1 and you do the same things? And what he's saying is that the issue here is moralists or Jews who had the law who are running around condemning these people for things that they're going to claim we're not even doing. You'll have to come back next week to figure that one out. But so is really the concern here is critical, self-righteous, religious people who are condemning those who don't fit their prototype. You starting to see how complicated this gets? So if you don't have some idea of this, we're just floundering in the dark. How do we respond and care for people who are different from us? And what does the Bible really say in terms of what we're doing? So they'll come back and they'll say, well, the whole issue in Romans 1 is hospitality, and the real concern is the injustices that we do with one another. And for those in chapter 2 who are part of the religious system, they just sit back and condemn other people. That's not helping at all. And in part, I will agree with him. That it's very easy for us as Christians to want to be right but have zero compassion. We want to have the truth, but we don't want to do anything to help sometimes. Now, sometimes that's bred out of a fear because we don't know what to do with this. Sometimes it's just anxiety because everything that I understand about the scriptures would say this wrong. How do I condone this and how do I work through it? So that becomes the challenge. Now, let me go back through those same PowerPoints. Go through those same passages and at least raise to you what some of the concerns I would have and some of the struggles I have in terms of the way these things are communicated. It would be, unless you've done this before, some of this would be really difficult to figure out just because of the nuances of it. So let's start back in Genesis chapter 18 as we begin to think about this. The hospitality element of this is really important. The idea here is that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, as expressed in here, in Ezekiel 16, it's, you know, to me, you know I'm a bit of a freak when it comes to context. And when it comes to Ezekiel 16:49, they're taking one verse, which happens to be one of the issues that is a problem here. But if you go back and read through the whole chapter, you'll just see that when God took Israel, when they were an infant squirreling and dying in a field, he rescued them, cleaned them up, beautified them, saved them, nurtured them, and raised them to be his own in relationship with God. And then it'll go on and talk about, you've committed adultery. You've spread yourself to all these nations, and you've sucked down all the stuff that they wanted, what you've desired from them, and they've even betrayed you, and you've gone back for more. The scriptures even there will say, God can't even describe them as a harlot, because a harlot got paid for their services. Israel, as a sense, was paying the other nations for being abused by them. They sacrifice their children in ritual ceremonial sacrifices. And I think one of the things that gets lost in this discussion is that I don't think you can reduce the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah to any one thing. You can't reduce it just to hospitality. Clearly the verse says that they were arrogant and proud, but it doesn't suggest that the inhospitability of what they did was the only thing where their arrogance flowered. And I don't think that homosexuality would be the one single thing that's the bad stuff that why God judged them. These people have been practicing evil and iniquities and trespasses and injustices for years. And they filled up their cup to the point where God says, I can't tolerate this anymore. I can't even find 10 righteous people in this community, these cities, and so his judgment is going to fall on them. And so that becomes part of the element. Now, when you go to Matthew 10, 14, and 15, what is not said about that particular statement is that Jesus sends out the 12, not to the Gentiles, but to the lost sheep of Israel, preaching that the kingdom of heaven is near. And the whole idea of that is that he says, listen, if they reject you and your message and won't greet and welcome you and be hospitable, then you shake the dust off your sandals. So it's not just like they're on vacation and they're popping in for a while and who's going to be hospitable and take them in. They're coming with a very strategic message from the Savior, the great shepherd for Israel. And he's saying, listen, the kingdom is here. They need to respond to that. And to reject the messengers was tantamount to rejecting the message. So it's not just about hospitality. It's about being ambassadors for the king and proclaiming the kingdom that Israel, as Jesus described it, was the lost sheep of Israel. They needed reconciliation with the king. And so to just say that it's simply hospitality would be wrong. To ignore that hospitality isn't part of it would also be wrong. And so it becomes a rather difficult issue. The other verse that's important is when it talks about Sodom and Gomorrah and the gang rape of homosexuality. I would tend to agree that there's a tremendous abusive nature to what is described in that particular text. But that does not mean that homosexual activity wasn't going on before that. It isn't like it just suddenly popped up and now all of a sudden this is the way they're going to humiliate some visitors. This is part of it. And the part that it does ignore is what Jude says, and that simply is that their activity, often like the angels who abandon their own domain and their proper abode, he is kept in eternal bonds as judgment. He says, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality, went after strange flesh. Now, that's not the only thing that's a problem in Sodom and Gomorrah. It's just kind of the final tip of the iceberg. It's kind of the icing on the cake of the last straw, the final element that God says, all right, I just can't let this go on in terms of what he's looking at. And so when you go back to the holiness code, I believe the holiness code is primarily concerned about living according to God's call of separating them out and living according to what God's righteousness and holiness is as determined by him, not just relationships with other people. It translates into that, but I think you're missing a huge piece about the holiness code if it doesn't originate and is sourced in God's character and how that translates into the community. It is true that holiness is about imitating God, loving neighbors, and caring for the vulnerable. But we can't care for people and ignore God's righteousness at the same time. It's not the same thing. When Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament law, it does not mean the Old Testament is irrelevant, but our point of authority is now anchored in the person of Jesus, not just legalities or rules. And we get that for when Jesus makes the statement in Matthew. He says, well, if a man looks at a woman and lusts after her, he's already committed adultery in his heart. Well, that goes way beyond simply the law. The law said, listen, if you've caught a woman caught in adultery and you can prove it, as it were, and there's no big ambiguity question about the thing, then the worst part of the punishment could be capital punishment. And I think they made adjustments in that depending on the situation. But the idea is that the holy Jesus fulfilled it. I think he upped the ante. He didn't reduce it. He talked about the character of the inner life as being the standard of what we live by. And so if a man lusted a woman, Jesus says, you've already committed adultery. That seems like a big jump. Is that really worse than actually doing it? I don't know. You'd have to ask Jesus, but I think he's upping the ante, not lowering it. And so that becomes part of the discussion. Christians pick and choose the elements of the code that we affirm and ignore, and there's no consistency. My response is, yeah, some of the Old Testament Leviticus code stuff is tough to figure out. There seems to be some stuff that's purely cultural. There seems to be some stuff that's really built for that particular nation in that context for health reasons. but there's other elements of this that seem to have a strong moral element to it. And just because we struggle of figuring that out doesn't mean you can unilaterally just give permission to do some parts of it. It requires study and scrutiny to understand really what the heart of God is. And so those are some of the things that are part of it. Now, if you move to this text, you shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination. And Leviticus 20, as we read before. Here, I want you to go back and listen to Ted's comments as we have it written here, and that is this. Certainly, these clearly condemn male-male sex. So he's willing to admit that. But then the next part where he says, in the absence of this clear, universalizable basis for such commendation or condemnation, we can't use this as a basis for decision. Now, the way I understand this, what he's saying, is that because it's not really universal amongst all the nations and all the people groups, there isn't enough evidence that other people bought into this, then it's invalid. And I'm going, well, let me think here for a minute. We live in a completely lost and broken world, so all the nations are going to set their own moral standards and ways of doing things right and wrong. So in the midst of this brokenness world, God is going to pick Abram and Abraham, and from that he's going to forge a family that's going to form a community that we call Israel, and within that particular community, not the ones outside of it, he's going to infuse a revelation that says, here's my standard of holiness and righteousness. My statement is, I think if God is who he is, why would you expect the other nations to buy into something that only God is giving to them? If God is revealing, this is the way I want you to live, and it comes from the character of God, not the brokenness of the nations, you're not going to find a lot of universality amongst all the other nations for the most part. You'll have some common sense of decency, and you will see that in terms of the ebb and flow in life, but just because it's unique doesn't mean it's irrelevant. Because that's the nature of who God is. His ways are different than our ways. His thoughts are different than our thoughts. As high as the heavens are from the earth, so his ways and thoughts are different than ours. And so at the heart of the holiness code, I would hope that living for God has a different moral code than just what we can make up on our own. If it doesn't, what's the point? Why chase after a God if it looks like everybody else? And so that becomes part of my concern and confusion with the idea of him saying, well, unless it's universalized and it's something that other people support that aren't part of that particular collective, then what difference does it make? You keeping up? Okay, I can make some of this available afterwards, but if I don't go this fast, we'll be like 15 weeks in this, and we'll get to Romans chapter 20 in probably 2019. So this is part of the discussion. Now, Jesus' theology of welcome. Here's a statement that I read before, so I won't go over it, but here is the text that he quotes in his own article. I can't tell. There we are. Jesus was going about all the cities and the villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Now, I would agree with this, is that this is what Jesus did, but he's using this as the basis to say people, Jesus welcomed all these people who were different than the regular religious establishment. But having said that, here's my concern. And I'm trying to word this carefully, but don't get lost here. I would agree with the idea and would even support the idea that our faith communities need to be a place of grace and healing. Based on this text out of Matthew, I might even entertain the idea of inclusiveness on one condition. Now, stay with me. One of the things that I noticed that Jesus doing is that he healed all these people of their afflictions. He didn't just welcome them and said, hey, join the club, and left them struggling in their affliction. My contention would be this. If you can talk to somebody who is part of the LGBT community and they wanted to belong to a faith community like ours and be part of it, I would be open to the idea of them participating with us if they are open to the idea that we would seek together with them that God would heal them the affliction of the same-sex attraction. I mean, that's what Jesus did. He healed people when they were in afflictions, no matter what the turmoil, the chaos, or the confusion. it says Jesus healed them of that. Now, part of the discussion that you have in this is that there's the people will say, well, I don't have anything to be healed about. This is my identity. And we'll talk about that later on. But that's the struggle they have in terms of conforming to that. And that's obviously the tension we're going to face if we're going to have people who come from same-sex attraction and struggle with that. How are we going to move alongside and help them in this journey and discover Christ? Now, we can say, go away, we don't want to have anything to do with you, but I'm not sure that models Christ. Just letting them do whatever they want, that seems to be a struggle. So how do we keep thinking through this? The other thing that I'm a little concerned about is that if this sense of identity is glued to this one particular thing in terms of our sexual orientation, it would seem to me that they are the only people in the entire world that can come to Christ and yet still stipulate that I'm not letting go of this. This is part of my identity. I don't know anybody in the planet who has ever come to Christ who comes stipulating that I'm keeping this about myself when I come to Christ. 2 Corinthians 5:17 says, we are a new creation. He creates a new person that now is created in holiness and righteousness and godliness, and it's only God can tell us what that's going to look like as we move forward. Nobody comes to Jesus saying, well, I'll come to you, but here's my conditions. And I don't think that they should have any exception to that. I don't have that privilege. I can justify a lot of things in my life, but that doesn't mean I'm right. The fundamental issue is when we come to Christ, we surrender. He makes us a new creation, and then we need to live out life in relationship to him according to his righteousness. Now, having said that, let me mention a couple more things. Embracing this biblical theme of inclusiveness, the statement is Jesus never condemned homosexuality. Well, some commentators will say that part of the Jewish world, they didn't have to. I mean, it was automatically assumed this was wrong, both by what is said in the Old Testament, and there's a certain, the Romans did a lot of stuff. But in the Jewish Judeo, as it were, our Judeo-Christian heritage, all the way back from God's revelation, this would have been a non-issue simply because of how the Jews understood what Leviticus had talked about in terms of the holiness code. But the other things that we need to pay attention to is that when you get to a verse like Matthew 19, they're talking about divorce. The Pharisees come and talk about divorce, and he says, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? And it's interesting that the Lord chooses to word it this way. Nobody but God would figure out that this needs to even be stated, because I wouldn't have put it this way. But he says, have you not read, he who created from them from the beginning made them male and female. He didn't just say made them a couple or anything else. He didn't just say he made them. He says, he made them male and female, and for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife. So Jesus may not have come out and see in the text that he explicitly condemns homosexuality, but I think it's just as important that we see what he affirms. That he affirms marriage between male and female. And that's the statement there. And yet I don't feel right. I don't feel comfortable just ignoring it to say, well, okay, now we can redefine marriage. I just struggle with that. I don't think that's being fair to Jesus' words and what he was trying to teach his disciples. Yeah, it was over divorce, but he's making a clear statement that from the beginning, this is what God designed. This was his orchestration. Now, they'll have a response to that, and we'll deal with that next week, but which you'll find very intriguing, I think, if we when we get to the nuts and bolts of that, because they do have a response, and it's worth knowing and understanding that. So, having said all that, what does it mean when I get to Romans? Because we are in Romans, believe it or not. What happens in Romans is I believe that this biblical theme of hospitality, I believe what they've done is that they overwhelm the context by saying this biblical sense of hospitality smothers the actual context and has it say something else. And the reason for that is because when you start in Romans 1:18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness and all ungodliness of men. What is that supposed to look like? Well, you'll notice these three statements, and then we're just going to have to close this up because we're well over time here. But the idea here is that the first thing doesn't deal with the injustices between people. It starts with our relationship with God, humanity's relationship with God. And look at the progression. They exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image. Is there any way, shape, or form that that's appropriate in any context? Of course not. Why to worship the creation apart from the one who created it is nonsensical. So that's the paradigm that we're working from. The second statement is they exchange the truth of God for a lie. So it's not only the truth of knowing about God, but the truth from God, that's been exchanged. And that's just as inappropriate as worshiping the creation as opposed to the creator. So I believe when you get down to this, this whole text is not dealing about just the injustices of people, although it's part of it. The whole thing is built on the foundation of humanity's suppressing the truth of God, of not honoring him as God, of not being thankful for that, and their minds are being darkened, and so those who profess to be wise become fools in God's eyes. This whole thing is built upon this relational element of how God looks at humanity and our relationship with him, not just the frivolous stuff that we do with one another. So having said that, let me try to leave you with something. Christ died for the whole world. He didn't come to condemn it. He came to save it. I think we need to have the same posture. Christ needs to, the church needs to value and respect all people, period. The problem is the way we often talk about other people who are different than us doesn't show respect and it doesn't value them as a person. And we need to struggle, we need to figure that out better than the way we often do. The church on mission, I think, needs to reflect what our own picture of a disciple is. We need to care about people, we need to connect, we need to show compassion, and we need to clarify. I don't see the word judge or condemn or ridicule or mock or slander anywhere in those statements. But for the Christian, the final authority needs to be God's word, and that's what we're struggling with. And I think we need to learn to listen to people's story. I think we need to learn about their journey. And I would suggest this, and I don't want you to misunderstand this. I think the starting point for us, not necessarily even the way we communicate it to people who struggle with this or are part of a gay and lesbian lifestyle, we need to begin looking at the condition of others first and foremost as our universal sense of brokenness, not an issue of choice. I'm not saying that choice isn't involved in these discussions when we get going, but this is where we need to start. Otherwise, it's very easy to be condemning and critical without appreciating people's brokenness. You wouldn't want people to do that with you, because I know every single one of you, if I could uncrack your life and look into your heart and mind, there's things that you do as Christians that go against the righteousness of God, and you do it by choice, and yet you have the avenue to say, God, please forgive me. And then we go, no, we don't. We try to avoid it as much as we can. I think this is the starting point, not the final end point, because we all deal with brokenness. Well, I hope that gave you enough to chew on this morning. Well, it gets more interesting as we go. This is a starting point. Believe me, I realize we can't be exhaustive, but I will wear you out trying to get through it. Let's pray. Father, we want to humbly bow before your throne of grace. We want to understand your truth, but we want to understand your heart as well. And so we ask for your profound wisdom and grace to continue to be our teacher, that we would learn to value and respect all people because they're created in your image. None of us are good. We all have brokenness. We need to discover how your grace and truth needs to impact not only our lives, but those around us. And so we ask for your truth and grace in our own lives in every possible way that we can. And we ask this in Christ's name. Amen.